Hey, we're still here at George Mason University. I'm here with Marina Castro Garcia from the University of Limerick now in Ireland. And we are here to discuss the article, and it starts with a hard Spanish word. So here we go. De Forticulacite, enacting critical intersectional feminist pedagogy in Spanish PEST. So physical education, sport, tertiary education. The article was recently published open access in PESP, so Journal of Physical Education and Sport Pedagogy. So you can find the full site of the article in the notes. And if you just click on the DOI, since it's open access, you can go directly to the paper. There's some good visual images that that are in the paper that kind of help support some of the stuff that we'll talk about. So Marina, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Risto. Well, thank you very much for the invitation to that amazing podcast. And before we start, I would like to also thank the co-authors of this paper, Dr. Dylan Landy and Professor David Kirk. I learned and enjoyed a lot writing this paper, and I hope that our listeners and readers can learn and enjoy it too.
And thanks for coming on. We talked about this paper at ICEP, and been waiting for this to come out because it was such a cool presentation, and the conversation around this, I found it very interesting. And in our podcast, we've talked about intersectionality before. Dr. Justin Hagel came on. There's two other podcasts that talk about intersectionality, so I've linked those in the show notes. But to start us off, I think it'd be good if you just give us a brief overview of what intersectionality means, and more specifically, explain the intersectional feminist pedagogy that we've not talked about before on this podcast.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think that the theory breakdown episode explains really well what intersectionality is. And as Dr. Justin Hagel explains in the episode, intersectionality is a framework that builds on feminism by exploring the unique forms of oppression that people face based on the interactional and intersection of multiple social identities. For example, it's not only gender, it's gender and sexuality and ability. Thus, we understand intersectional feminist pedagogy as an approach that merges the theoretical principles of critical and feminist pedagogies with the advances made by intersectionality. In so doing, the planning of a critical intersectional feminist pedagogical approach means, amongst others, raising critical consciousness to the diversity of experiences among social identities, and producing dialectical encounters to explore other social identities.
So can you explain, so you use Spanish physical education, sport, tertiary education, which is kind of like PESTE in the paper. And I was interested to read a little bit about it, but can you talk about why in Spain that area is considered to be a highly masculinized space?
Yes. So first of all, in relation to the diacronym, I think it's interesting to highlight that contrary to other contexts, in Spain, there are no undergraduate PET programs. And that's why we use this other this other word. So what we have are PEST programs that usually sit within a broader sport and physical education department and prepare a range of professionals that include future sport coaches, sport managers, fitness instructors, physical educators, and others. And these programs are dominated by traditional sports skills and biophysical science courses, where content around social equity is lacking. And within this reality, women comprise less than 20% of students and academics. And that is one of the reasons why university applicants have labeled PEST programs as highly masculinized.
So you said there's no undergraduate PET program. So let's say I'm a equivalent of a high school graduate. I want to be a PE teacher. In Spain, what do I enroll in? How do I become a PE teacher?
So you have to enroll in that PEST programs, and then you need a master. So you need a professional master of education in PE. So if you want to become that's for secondary school. So if you want to be a PE teacher in secondary schools, whereas if you want to be a PE teacher in primary schools, you have to enroll in an education program and then have like a specialization in physical education, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it's also interesting to know that some PESTE programs in Spain, not all, but for instance, the one that I was in and the one that is enrolled in that research, you need to go through physical tests before going to the PESTE program.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's why it's
what's the physical tests?
You have to run, you have to swim, you have to do gymnastics, you have to do things with the ball, like dribbling and all the balls. So it's very traditional sports skills.
Interesting. So if you're a dancer and you are elite level dancer and you have a passion for movement, you'd have to learn how to do all those other like traditional sports skills to be, even be enrolled in or get accepted into a program.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter if you're a professional dancer or no.
Yeah. Okay. So can you give us an overview of the study? Like what happened in the study that we're talking about?
In terms of methods or...
Yeah, just in terms of like what did you do methods wise? Like what did the research study look like?
Yeah. So, well, this is part of my PhD. So this paper it's part of a larger participatory action research design that explores the enactment of the Portigualízate curriculum in Spanish physical education settings. The project had multiple phases that include curriculum development, consultation, enactment, amongst others. And for this paper, what I think it's important to know is that it's focused on the enactment of the Portigualízate curriculum in a class within a PESTE program in the context that I have already explained you. Data were generated using questionnaires, reflecting field notes, artifacts, and group interviews. And finally, we analyzed them using multiple data analysis methods that included immersion, critical events, narrative analysis, descriptive and concept coding, conceptual mapping, and deductive analysis.
So, can you explain the meaning of that word? And this is the last time I'm going to try to say it because you say actually how it's supposed to say it. De particularite.
Well done.
Oh, thanks. I'm really trying here. Can you tell us about that curriculum? What is it? How does it work? What did you implement?
Yeah, sure. So, well, first of all, just for you to know, that's a word game in Spanish. It's not an actual noun. It's something that I invented and combines the word deporte, which is sport, with igualdad, which is equality. So it could be something like sport equalization. That makes sense. This is a curriculum unit originally developed for young people and then adapted for PESTE students. The purpose of the unit is to teach about inequities that persist in sports through an intersectional feminist lens. The development of the Portigualízate was a multi-stage process that included consultation with young people, PESTE students, PESTE faculty, physical educators, and equity experts. And I encourage the listeners of this podcast to see the curriculum outlining in the paper and to read our forthcoming paper about the curriculum development itself.
Yeah, I know that you have some other papers coming out, which is going to be great to add on to this. When we talk about your findings, you introduced two activities to show how this curriculum led students to develop awareness, challenge their beliefs, and reflect on the concept of equity in society. I'm wondering if you can briefly explain the first activity and tell us about the reaction of the students and their expressed feelings with this activity.
Yeah, sure. So both activities were selected as critical moments that characterized important events based on students' feedback. The first one that we present is the Who is Who? And this activity consisted in showing pictures of different bodies playing sports, hiding the athlete's face, and other features to make it difficult to identify the sex of the athlete. As you said at the beginning, we've got an image in the paper, so I encourage the readers to go and just have a look to understand what I'm saying. So then students were asked to discuss what do they see in those pictures. For example, I showed them the arm of Teresa Portela, who is a Spanish canoist. Students started to say that it's a very muscular arm or that it's biologically impossible for a woman to have this arm. And after discussing 10 images, we had the gender reveal. by showing them the whole picture of the athlete and other and their main achievements in sports. Finally, I asked them, the students, what do they see? And in so doing, students' preconceived notions about gender in sports were jarred by having to confront their embodied emotions and beliefs. This activity then raised a critical kinesthetic consciousness about how stereotypes have been taught through sport.
Yeah, and the image you have, just to kind of describe, is of a canoer, a world-class Summer Olympic medalist canoeer, and has a little smiley face on top of her head. So you can't see, but if you look at it, has no other identifying information other than like a very muscular arm pulling a stroke in a canoe. And then when you take that out, it's, you know, you see like a hair bun and you see a female face. And so did you do a bunch of these different pictures and throughout, and they were going, you one by one had them kind of think about why that person seems male or female? What are the features?
Yeah, so I showed them 10 pictures and they were all Spanish athletes. So that's also interesting because then we start to discuss not only gender, but also how mass media is acting in those preconceptions and so on. So first I showed them all the pictures, like just an arm or leg, or for example, the leg of a man doing synchronized swimming. And then they started to say, oh, that's a very small feet. And because it's very small, it might be a woman. But I don't ask them, like, why do you see a woman or why do you see a man? It says, what do you see?
Yeah.
That's the only question that I ask them. And then they start just discussing a lot. And it's very, very interesting.
So you didn't say, like, do you see a male foot or a female foot?
It's, no.
What do you see? And then they took it to the gender conversation.
And that's very interesting because in Spanish, we've got masculine and feminine words. So you see, for example, un deportista or una deportista. So it's very easy to identify if they're expressing like female athlete or male athlete. And they just discuss this. But I don't ask them, why do you see a woman? Just how things come quickly. Because of those preconceptions.
Right. Interesting. Well, what about the second activity? Can you talk about that and some of the emotions that the students express, and also how your students discuss ways of taking action to make a difference in that shared community?
Sure. So the second activity was the privilege walk. On this occasion, instead of doing the privilege based on their own identities, I gave students a note card with different descriptions of people. For example, man, 21, black, deafblind, mother is a teacher, father is a lawyer. Then students were asked to visualize, embody, and perform the person on their note card before running this digital race. And it was digital because due to COVID-19, I had to modify the activity into a digital version, which was an extra challenge. By putting one's feet into other person's shoes, the activity helped to develop empathy, care, and love for others. And importantly, Deportivolízate required students to complete workbooks at home and do activities with others in their communities. For example, they had to analyze social media with their peers. Yet some students, like Pamela, which is a pseudonym, took it a step farther by using her time with young people in her coaching role to enact the privilege walk, promoting new transformations in new people.
Yeah, and I think like the privilege walk, the one of the first ones that I saw, like I don't know, several years ago, was this YouTube video that went viral from some camp, and it was a coach that said, here's $100, and had a bunch of people line up, and then they take physical steps every time they have something like, do you live in a two-parent household? Did you have money to go to college? Did you have this? And it, I think the visualization, okay, it's great, right, that you see it, but it's also, it puts those people on the spot. Like, it's very, very, like, degrading, demeaning, sad for the person who isn't leaving the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done almost to the to show the white privilege or show the privileged kids like, oh, look back, look at all these people behind you, look at how privileged you are. But I love that you did this through Kahoot. Even yep. I know it was like a COVID-19 adaptation, but you gave people roles to play, and then it was done digitally through a Kahoot, which you could do in a classroom now, because they were just answering questions based on the role they were given, and nobody was put on the spot. So what went through your, like, why did you decide to do it that way, and in a way to give people roles to play instead of playing their own roles? Did you have a thought process behind that?
Yes. The digital race was the adaptation due to COVID-19, but giving roles was my first plan. And I did that in my piloting with secondary school students because I didn't want anybody to be in the spot, first of all. And then I wanted to be diverse in terms of identities and social identities in order to discuss how society is hierarchical and to discuss these privileges and oppressions. Because, for example, in my class, there was only one Black student. But imagine that you don't have any Black students, or I didn't have any deaf student, but I wanted to discuss about disabilities, and I didn't have any people in my class with any disability. And because I wanted that, and I wanted that diversity, I created those roles. And I also did another thing that I think it's really interesting, is that I didn't put all the characteristics in all the roles. For example, sometimes it only said men, and that's it. And then you have to imagine, how is that man? Where does he live? Who is their family? What do they have, money or not? Do they have friends or not? How is his body? Or I didn't put in any of the descriptions if that person was fat or thin or tall or short. Or and then when we finished, I asked them, so after all the discussion, I asked them, how did you imagine yourself? And nobody imagined themselves as, I don't know, as non-physically active. And that's really interesting as well. How do we imagine ourselves based on this privilege?
Yeah. Interesting. So I guess when I read it, I felt like the first activity led your students to reflect on their personal beliefs, while the second activity then pushed the boundary to kind of critique social inequities. Do you feel like that's a correct interpretation?
Well, in some way, yes. So the first activity we discuss in the paper has a direct encounter with students' preconceptions, belief, and beliefs, whereas the other one is more focused on social inequities broadly. Nevertheless, all the activities are connected. So as, for example, as I said to you before, the discussion after the gender reveal led us to debate on how bodies, sports, and colors are gendered, but also how this is a social construction. And for example, we examined the role of mass media, as I said before, in the construction of gender, understanding how our own beliefs are connected to broader social inequities. So therefore, although through different approaches, the whole curriculum relied on a range of factors, including theory, embodiment, and effect, to move students intellectually and emotionally around issues of equity in physical activity.
So as we kind of wrap this up, I'm wondering if you can share how the students supported each other in the process of navigating their emotion and developing criticality in your classes. What was that like?
Well, first of all, I consider it important to know that students felt there was value in expressing their opinions and emotions. And that's important because I was sharing my emotions and opinions too. And there was value in doing that. We all created a safe space to express ourselves, and that space promoted open debates, dialectical processes, and interchange of ideas from diverse perspectives. By listening to each other and understanding each other, this safe space was developed into a caring space where we all try to support each other. Nevertheless, it isn't realistic to think that this was an easy and a straightforward process, as you can imagine. There was a lot of diversity in the class. So there were times of conflict and resistance. these conflicts, however, enrich the debates. And at the end of the day, this is the real life.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's good to have those conversations. And, you know, yes, there will be conflict and differing ideas, but we don't talk about it. If we don't have this conversation, I think it doesn't help anybody involved. So I'm wondering, as you go forward, you've been working on this project for a while. You have this open access paper published. Can you give us a sneak peek on what the other topics will be? Like, what are your other papers that are forthcoming? Like, what do you cover in those?
Yeah, sure. So the first phase before developing this curriculum, I did questionnaires on gender stereotypes in physical education based on students' ideas and physical education teachers' ideas and stereotypes too. So this is one paper exploring if gender stereotypes are still persistent in physical education or not. Then we've got another paper on the curriculum development itself, which is a whole process where we reflect on all the decisions that we made and why, because this was not a straightforward process. As I said before, there were a lot of people involved in that, lots of decisions. And then I think it's also interesting on that paper that sometimes what we think it's going to be a good idea, it is not, because the reality is what it is. So just for you to know, I wanted to make a whole curriculum, like all the year of the class, and it was not possible. And then I said, okay, I'm going to do it in 10 sessions. And then they said, no, Marina, you're not going to do that in 10 sessions. We're not going to give you 10 sessions. And then I have to shorten it. So it reflects all that process and negotiation. And then we want to publish other papers on the whole enactment, because after that, I enacted this with 300 students, secondary school students, and we've got loads of things to explore there on how students engage and explore that curriculum.
Yeah, that's interesting, the negotiation of like what a researcher wants to do, what seems right, and then the negotiation of like, this is how much time we're going to give to you, like figure it out. And the ability, I love that you have taken this to kind of higher education past programs and then enacted it into secondary schools. So I can only imagine how much data you have to kind of publish in for the next several years fun to follow.
Thank you. And also how I had to navigate my own self as a teacher, because this kind of curriculum, it's not straightforward, as I said. It's not 2+2=4. You never know how students are going to react. You never know how the discussion is going to be. So all this critical feminist pedagogy itself, it's a thing to explore and to experience.
And I guess it's interesting too, like if you think about, if you want to, as a PhD, develop a curriculum, you have to, especially something like this, you have to understand the context. You can't give a handbook, like a thick paper binder, to a teacher who doesn't understand the background of this and say, run these lessons. This is your roadmap to do this, which would be nice if you could, because then you could, you know, export your curriculum everywhere. But how do you feel about that, in the sense that, like, how much are you a key player in developing this or delivering this curriculum? Like, could you teach me how to teach this curriculum in Virginia or in somewhere else in the US? Like, how does, I guess the scaling up is my question, because I feel like work that you're doing is really cool, really meaningful. The paper is really well written, and it shows how that specific group of people benefited from your curriculum. But is your curriculum meant to be scaled up? Can you teach me how to teach that curriculum in my class? Or they're not supposed to do that.
Well, first of all, thank you for your words on the paper. I really appreciate that. Well, we are working on some key principles, if that makes sense, of that curriculum. So that's not a curriculum for everybody just to take it as it is and enact it in another context, because as you said, every context is different. So even for me, I was the same teacher in different contexts and had to adapt it every single day that I was doing that. Because it's not the curriculum, it's all the context, the students, even if it's raining or not, this affects our students' emotions and feelings and how they are doing things. So we are working on those principles in order for anybody who wants to engage in this kind of work to just take those principles and try to adapt it in their own settings. So our focus here, our aim is to develop a curriculum which is flexible enough and open enough so anybody who really understands that can just do it themselves, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So do you need a PhD to run this?
I could.
what I'm asking, I guess, is like, can a teacher who does not understand critical feminist intersectionality, can they deliver this in the way that you would want them to?
I'm sure they could. I'm sure.
Yeah.
And so you don't need, sorry, I misunderstand your question. No, you don't need a PhD to run that. And I'm sure that a lot of teachers, physical education teachers, can do it very well, even better than a PhD.
Yeah. And that the benefit is they understand their students. And this has been like a long standing kind of thing floating around my brain, because when I was in grad school, I worked on Laura Azevedo's projects of the body curriculum and kind of like the stop photoshopping thing about how students perceive, body image and fitness and fatness and all these different things. And it was such a wonderful project. But that never left the Journal of Sport Education Society or PESP, wherever the papers were published. And but then you compare that to something, have you heard of the Dove body curriculum? It's a big in the US. They're always at Shape America. They're at different state physical education conferences. Dove is it's a soap brand, I think. but they obviously it's a very corporate curriculum, but they hand this out for free and they give tutorials on how to do it, and they have prepackaged lesson plans that people can use. And the benefit is that any PE teacher that is out there can download the Dove body curriculum and teach about body image. But it's not context specific, and it doesn't ask the teacher to go through and study what the effects would be when you start talking about this stuff. And I wonder, in that spectrum, where do you feel like your curriculum fits? Like, it's not a corporate curriculum that you can just download and implement without the context, but I see it as valuable in the sense that you could actually implement a lot of these. And I don't think it's only going to live in PESP as a thought exercise for academics.
No, that's a really good point. I don't want that to be like a magical recipe where anybody could just download it and put it in action in their class. That's not my my aim. But I could I did some training with PE teachers, and I implement some of those activities with them so they can embody these activities and they can experience with their own emotions, preconceptions, and bodies, how does it feel? And then they can adapt it to their own classes. And I'm also publishing some papers in, I don't know how is it called in English, like journals that are just for teachers. It's not research.
Yeah, like in the US, it would be Joe Bird or Strategies. They're focused for teachers, not necessarily like academic researchers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm also publishing there. So I don't want that to be only for academics. That's not my aim. I want academics to think about that. It's fine. And I want to do research on that. It's very cool. But I want physical education to be more democratic, just, and equitable for everybody. So that's why I want teachers to access that as well. But as I told you, I don't want Deportivo Alicante to be like a magical recipe. I just want to build up those principles in order to anybody to just adapt them to their own context and also their own point in their lives. Maybe you're not able to do some of the things that I did, and maybe in the future I'm able to do things that I wasn't able to do previously, because you as a teacher are a key role in all that as well.
Yeah, awesome. I'm so looking forward to seeing where this goes. I feel like paper's great. I think the future stuff is super interesting, especially when you implement this at the secondary level. So thanks for coming on. I really appreciate your time, and we'll see you at ICEP in Finland.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Krista. It's been a pleasure being here. And yes, I'll see you in ICEP.
So thanks, everybody, for listening. The links are in the show notes. And as always, I want to thank Alba Rodriguez for her help in helping produce this podcast. Thanks, Marina.
Thank you.